I thank you for these pastors and church leaders who come in from all over the Northeast. And God, I pray your blessings on this day. Use Steve to speak to us and to teach us how we can be better leaders of our church, how we can be better stewards of the money and the people that you've entrusted to us. So we give you these next 3 hours, and we pray this together in Jesus' name. And everyone who agreed said,
amen.
Amen. Everybody say hello, Steve.
Hey, guys. Guys, it's great. It's great to be with you today. And guys, I think this is such an important part of what we do in ministry, not only because it provides resources for the work that we do, but it's a great way to bless your people. I really do believe with all my heart, and I hope you believe as well, that it is more blessed to give than receive. Hope you believe that. Hope you've experienced that in your own life, because your people need that blessing. You're not putting a burden upon your people to ask them to be good stewards. You're setting them free. Every time they give of their resources, they give away a little bit of their selfishness. And every time they do, they invest in eternity, and they're storing up treasures in heaven. And moth can't get to that. Thieves can't get to that. And the Bible also says that wherever a man's treasure is, there his heart will be also. And the best way to get your people's heart in the right place is to get their treasure in the right place. Now, guys, if you believe that, you're not going to be shy about asking your people to invest in eternity. If you had insider stock information in terms of, I think that's illegal, isn't it, to pass that on? But if you were making an investment and you were getting an unbelievable return off of it, and you had some folks that you really loved and you wanted them to get in on this, you would not be shy about that. And yet it's amazing to me the number of church leaders who hold their head down and kick the dirt when they start talking about finances in their church. It's amazing to me the number of folks who do not develop donors in their church. They just shy away from that. And here's the truth, guys. If you're the senior pastor of a church, I know we have some folks who are not senior pastors here, but if you're the senior pastor of the church, you're the chief financial officer of your church. No one can raise money in your church like you can, or raise the resources. And it's not anybody's job. And it's the one thing, guys, it's one of just a very handful of things that you can't delegate. Well, I have a teaching team at the church where I lead, and I've learned from experience that if I preach any less than 30 weeks a year, and I know that sounds like a small number, but I've crunched it down. If I preach any less than 32 weeks a year, that I can't lead my church. Teaching is not my number one gift. If I could delegate more of that, I would delegate it, because it sets me free for strategic leadership. But I've pushed that envelope, and if I go lower than 32, if I hand off more than 20, I can't lead. And so that there's nobody can take that primary teaching role except for the senior pastor, the primary teaching role, the bulk of it, and lead through their teaching. And in the same way, nobody can raise the resources for you to do the kingdom work in your church other than you. I'm just sorry. You can't hand that off. Doesn't matter if it doesn't fit your personality. Doesn't matter if it doesn't fit your gifting. You're the guy that has to do that, or you're the gal that has to do that. So I just say that as a preamble to the whole thing. Let's go ahead and open up our syllabus, and what we're going to do is run through this. I want you to know that I'm very, very comfortable with you raising your hand and challenging something that I've said. Please don't catch all my math mistakes on the board here, but just, you know, the big picture things. Or sticking up a hand saying, wait a minute, what do you mean by that, or how do you do that? So as much interaction as you want, we're going to rip through this pretty fast. But we'll slow down whenever you want, okay? So let's start there. Let's talk about developing donors. Several things that need to happen. One is to cast vision. Guys, people typically do not give to sinking ships, okay? And some of you think that the way to raise money is to send out a letter to all your people telling them that you're $100,000 behind in your budget. And that's about the worst thing that you can do, okay? I think you can go to that well about once every 5 years at most, to let people know that we've got a special need and everybody needs to step up. But if that is your standard operation of raising money, you're going to discourage your people more than you're going to raise money. You can't just keep on crying wolf like that. It doesn't work. People give to vision, true vision, compelling vision versus the other. Now, how do you cast that vision of this is something that's worth investing in? How do you cast that vision that part of spiritual formation is for them to become generous givers? Well, obviously you do it through sermons. And again, it amazes me the number of pastors who do not on a regular basis preach the whole counsel of God. And you guys have read it in other places. There's more written on giving and stewardship in the Bible than both heaven and hell combined. And if you're not dealing with it, you're not dealing with the whole counsel of God. And obviously there's several ways that you can do that. One of the ways that you can do that is you can you can preach a series of messages. Now, in our situation, everybody's different in the room, but our situation, we basically do topical exposition. In other words, we'll choose a topic and do a 4, 6, 8 week series on it. We'll actually have a text that we exegete, but it's on that topic. And so you can choose to do a 4 or 5 week series on stewardship and deal with it. When I deal with stewardship, I like to deal with more than just the financial aspect. I like to talk about stewardship of influence. I like to talk about the stewardship of service. I like to talk about the stewardship of giving as well. So it's seen it as a larger situation, and I'll talk a little bit more about that later on today. Another way that you can do it is it can be a part of a series. So you can maybe do a series about impacting your world. And you can have one sermon on giving as a part of that impacting your world. Or you can do one on commitment, and you have one aspect of it. So it can be a whole series about giving or stewardship. It can be one part of a series that's a larger series. Or you can do a one-off message. And so you can just, you've done a four-week series, then you come back and you have one standalone message. And so there's several ways that you can approach it, but I think you need to hit it in all those different ways. For example, I'm doing a series this summer. We typically do a 10-week series during the summer because it's actually a pseudo-series because we realize that nobody attends 2 weeks in a row in the summer. Staff doesn't even attend 2 weeks in a row in the summer. And so we got a 10-week series called How right now, and I'm preaching a message in 2 weeks on how to manage your money. And so I'm going to be talking about just how to manage your money. In this economy, that's going to be a pretty high interest message. And a sub point in there is going to be the stewardship aspect of that. And so there's a lot of different ways you can do that. But guys, you lead from that platform. And you've got to be talking about money in a lot of different contexts. Second way is in new members workshop. I hope you have a workshop where you give an orientation to your members to help them get a good start. We do a new members workshop on a Sunday evening once a month where we invite our folks to come in. And I teach that myself because I think that says something about the importance of that. And during that workshop, we tell them what church membership means because we want to start off with a clear understanding of what church membership means. Somebody's described football once as 22 people in desperate need of rest being watched by thousands of people in desperate need of exercise. And that's a pretty good description of the church sometimes, isn't it? And so what we say at the new members workshop is, guys, something has changed here. You've been in the stands, and you've had your pennant, and you've had your popcorn, and you've been critiquing the sermon and enjoying the worship and everything else. But today you step outside of the stand, you step on the field, and when you step on the field, you wear a helmet, even if it messes up your hair. You put on a uniform, even if it's not your primary color, and then you're going to block, you're going to tackle, you're going to throw, you're going to carry water, you're going to do something, okay? And we talk about some basic commitments in that. And here's the basic commitments that we say that there. And these are not suggestions, by the way. This is check the box if you're willing to do these things. One is you're going to get involved in a small group. If you're not ready to get in a small group, crawl back up in the stands. Be a fan, but don't call yourself a member, because members put themselves in a position for relational stewardship. That way, in other words, they're putting themselves in a position to know and be known, to put themselves in a position of being ministered to, but also ministering to others. Second of all, you're going to make a commitment to share. And by that, we mean that you're going to keep a list of at least 3 people that you know who are unchurched that you're praying for, seeking to witness to, and seeking to invite to Lake Point. Okay? As long as you're a member of Lake Point, starting today, you're going to have an impact card, is what we call it, where you're seeking to pray. You're praying for these people every day. You're seeking to witness to them, and you're seeking to invite them. The third thing that you're going to make a commitment to is you're going to make a commitment to a regular quiet time of your own. In other words, you're going to become a self-feeder. You're not going to depend upon what we do once a week. And that's a time of prayer and Bible study. And what we're asking you to do is to shoot for 7, hit five. We're going to consider it a success if you have a quiet time 5 times a week. But you're committing as you become a member to do that. Number four, you're making a commitment to serve somewhere. All right? You're going to find some place in the church to serve. We're going to give you about 3 months to find it. If you don't find it in 3 months, we'll help you. We'll assign something to you. So find something you like before we get to you. All right? And then the last thing is we're going to ask you to give. And we teach during that time what biblical giving is, and what we would say is biblical giving is, first of all, systematic. In other words, you answer the question, how often am I going to give? How often am I going to go, or when am I going to give? And typically we say to folks, if you get paid once a month, you ought to give once a month. If you get paid once a week, you ought to give once a week. If you get paid, you know, quarterly, you ought to give quarterly. As God blesses you, you ought to give. The second thing we say about biblical giving is that it needs to be proportionate. And by proportionate, that's basically the whole concept of a tithe. We give 10% because it represents the fact that God really owns all of it. It's symbolic of that first fruit. And the principle here, guys, is real, real simple. If God has blessed you a lot, you ought to give a lot. Amen. And God has just blessed you a little, then you just give a little. And if God has not blessed you materially at all, you're totally off the hook. Okay? Yeah, and there's some folks who may find themselves in that situation. And then last of all, the Bible teaches that it's sacrificial. Sacrificial. And what we teach our folks, although we teach what you guys are familiar with, the 10-10-80 plan, which is that you give 10, you save 10, and then you live on 80%. Versus the world's plan, which is you live on 110%. Okay? Those are your two choices there. But although we teach this, guys, I do believe that there comes a time in your life where 10% is no longer sacrificial. Mm-hmm. Where you begin to, God begins to give you excess. And when that happens, I think that formula has to change. You know, whenever I talk on giving, I know that there's three groups out there. There's some folks in that audience who've never given anything. And you know where they need to start? They need to start giving something. They can't even imagine giving 10%. Mm-hmm. But they need to start giving something. If it's $10 a week, start giving something. Because if they do that, they're going to find out it's more blessed to give than receive. Mm-hmm. Okay? It's going to prime the pump. Second of all, there are folks who've been giving what I would call token gifts. It's where the offering plate's coming and they're scrambling to find the smallest bill that they can find in their pocket so they can throw it in the plate. And those folks need to move to the 10-10-80 plan. Mm-hmm. Okay? And then there's that third group of people in my congregation who I've been given the 10-10-80 plan since they were kids, and they're proud of it, and they're legalistic about it, and they divide the mint and the dill in the garden in a process. They're a bunch of Pharisees is what they are, and they're looking down on everybody else whenever I preach on stewardship, and it's time that they move beyond threshold giving. Because, guys, that's what this is. This is not where it ends, guys. This is where it begins. And if we give 10%, there's a wonderful thing that happens above the 10%. It's called what I call spirit-led giving. Okay? Spirit-led giving. And you got three groups. And every time you preach, you just go ahead and you can give three invitations. Some of you today need to start deciding to give something. Some of you today need to start tithing. Some of you today need to go beyond the tithe and you need to get into spirit-led giving. Okay? Guys, that alone may be worth the trip today. Okay? So, but at New Members Workshop, we say you cannot be a member unless you make a commitment. And what we do is we actually give them boxes and they check all five of those boxes. Yes, we understand this is what membership means. Yes, we understand this is what it means to be on the team. And then when we end that time together, I teach for 2 hours, and then they actually go and get a meal and then sit down with an existing church member who will help them plan their first year of church membership, okay? And there's actually a business plan. They go through it, and they say, okay, have you found a small group yet? And they go, no, I haven't. Okay, then we're going to put a box there that you need to find a small group. And then let me suggest to you 5 small groups. And then they say, have you found a place to serve yet? Well, I used to work in the youth ministry in my old church. Great. Let me put down here the contact email address of our youth minister so that you can contact them. And this is done in duplicate so that we're taking it and we're going to copy them to the youth minister We're giving a copy to the five small groups that they might be interested in. So we're working it from both sides. And then when it comes to the giving part, it says, have you decided when you're going to give, how much you're going to give, and is your giving level, does it need to go to the next level to be sacrificial? And they will say yes or no. They don't tell that host what they're going to give, but they either check the box that yes, they've done that, or they create the box that says that's something we need to go home tonight as a couple, and we need to make those decisions so we can start doing that. So there's an application part of that. But between the teaching part and when they get their meal and sit down and do the business plan for the first year, they actually walk out right before the food line. I'm standing there, and they handing this commitment card where they've committed these five things with their signature. They put it in my left hand, and I shake their right hand, kind of like graduation, okay? It's what we call the magic moment, all right? We warn them they may or may not feel anything when they shake my hand, okay? There have been people who've been slain in the spirit. People have seen visions. For the most part, it's a rather stoic experience, but it's an important exchange to say, okay, I agree to be on the team, and I understand what it means to be on the team. See, guys, part of the problem is you've never made it clear what the expectations are. And we lower those expectations, or we keep them fuzzy, which is worse than lowering the expectations. And then we wonder why our people don't do what we're expecting them to do, because we've never told them what to do. Yes, sir.
Did you say a couple of minutes ago that you actually talk to the individual about how much they're giving?
No, we do not. What they do is they actually, the host, will talk to them about whether or not they have decided when and how much and if it is sacrificial, but not the specific numbers. Okay?
Now,
yeah, the question was, do I actually talk to the individual about how much they're giving? And the answer to that is no, I don't. But the host at the table talks about if they've made their decision about those components of giving. Okay? Now, we do ask for specific numbers. Once a year, and I'm about to get to that in a moment, once a year we have an annual commitment where they'll turn in a commitment card. And it's interesting, though, guys, when we ask for the annual commitment, let me kind of hop over there while we've got that question. We ask them, will you recommit yourself to being involved in a small group? And then it says, by the way, what small group are you in? And they list the small group at that point. And then we say, will you commit yourself to share Christ with those who don't know? And by the way, who is on your impact card? And they actually list the names. It says, are you currently having a quiet time, or will you commit to have a quiet time? And then you list whether you're doing it in the morning, afternoon, or at night. And then it says, will you commit or recommit yourself to serve? And by the way, where's your service? What team are you on, or where are you serving? And then it says, and will you commit yourself to give? And then it asks the question, what will you give to the general fund? What will you give to the building fund? And what will you give to the missions fund? So once a year, we re-up everybody. Okay, but when we do that, we actually do ask for the specifics, but it's not face to face with someone. It's a commitment card that actually they can write, and they write two copies of it, and they keep a copy for themselves, and the other part folds over so that they can turn it in during a worship service where we have our annual recommitment. And that's usually about the third week of January of every year, because everybody's got their new salaries and everything else. But when we ask for commitments, anytime we ask for commitments, we're not asking just for money. We're asking for them to recommit themselves to what we call basic Christian disciplines in the church that help us to be a team together. Okay? So great question. Yes, sir.
See, the materials that you're using both for your new members workshop, that card that you use, is that available as a resource anywhere that we could have access to?
That's a great question. The question is the commitment card that we use at the new members workshop and the annual recommitment card, is it available as a resource, and it is in the book Money Matters in the Church. So you can get a copy of that. And let me just say this, that if we run out today, Nelson, what's the best way for them to get that book if we run it?
Follow up email with a link to Amazon.
Great. And then, or you can get it off of Amazon. It's available currently on Amazon. All right?
Thank
yes, sir.
So
be cheaper today, by the way.
So do you think it's too much of a commitment to require people to tithe before they become a member? Because that's one of the things we do is we say you got to commit to tithing.
Okay, the question is, do you think it's too much of a commitment to ask people to tithe before they become a member? My personal opinion is that it's not too much of a commitment to ask them to give. I do not ask that they tithe. You notice what I say is I say to give systematically, proportionately, and sacrificially is what we're asking them to do. And I say to them at the new members workshop, some of you are not giving anything. I'm going to ask you to give something. In fact, every once in a while I have somebody raise their hand and they'll say, Steve, and guys, by the way, if you disagree with me on this theologically, that's fine. I understand that. I'm just telling you what we do. But guy raises his hand and he says, now wait a minute, Steve, you're asking us to give. If we're a member, how much do we have to give to keep that commitment? And I said, at least $1 a year. Is that fair? But don't you dare call yourself a member and not at least give $1 a year. Guys, I don't know anybody who gives $1 a year, okay? So what we're asking them to do is to move to the next category, and we're teaching that to be in obedience to God, they need to get at least a threshold given. So we teach where it is. But guys, think about it. You don't ever say to people who are joining your church, okay, get rid of all the sin in your life before you join.
Right.
Okay? Mm-hmm. But you still teach what the standard of the Scripture is, and you ask them to make a commitment to move toward that standard. So that's what we're doing. If that answers your question. All right?
Can I give you one more quick one?
Yes, please do.
How often do you do a series on stewardship, like a 4-week or so?
That's a great question. The question is, how often do we do a series on stewardship? I don't think I have a catalytic system regarding that. In other words, I don't have this thing that, you know, once a year or twice a year or anything like that. I know we deal with it every year at least once, but because I understand how important it is, that's the only reason I don't have a catalytic system. You may need to create one in your setting if you've been avoiding it. You may need to say, I'm going to do a stewardship series every year. See, when we sit down and we plan preaching, we sit down and we say, okay, when was the last time we did a stewardship series? When was the last time we did a theological series? When was the last time we did an Old Testament, New Testament? When was the last time we did a value series about the values of the church? When was the last time we did spiritual discipline, spiritual form? So we're trying to keep that balance all the time. We're dealing with that, but we have that process by which we're doing that. If you look up, guys, and it's been over a year since you've preached a stewardship message, or series of messages on stewardship, you probably need a catalytic system where you say, I'm going to make a rule that I'm going to preach on it at least 4 times a year, 4 Sundays a year, either in a series or set-asides or, as you know, you may need that discipline, all right? Okay, small groups. Guys, I think that small groups is one of the best places to deal with the stewardship issue because you've already got the convinced. See, I think there's three kinds of activities that you have in your church. You've got activities for the curious. You've got some for the convinced. And then you've got activities for the contagious contributor. I call it level 1, level 2, and level 3. And so whenever something goes on the calendar, whenever we're doing staff, we're doing planning, I always want to say, is this a level 1 activity, level 2 activity, level 3 activity, okay? In our model, it may not be in your model, but in our model, small groups are a level 2 activity, okay? Leadership training would be a level 3 activity, okay? Easter for us, I don't know about you guys, and again, different strategy, everything. Leader for us is a level 1 activity. Okay, that's our best chance. We got more lost people showing up at church on Easter. Only exception is Christmas Eve. Christmas Eve has become the second Easter. But what I don't want to do is talk to the convents on those 2 days because I've got more lost people than ever before. What I want to do is I want to, in a creative and engaging way, share Christ and plant that seed on that day. Now, any other Sunday during the year, the struggle you have is that Sunday morning for us or Saturday night, because we have Saturday night services, is both a level 1 and level 2 activity. It's a chance to help grow Christians, but also introduce people to Christ. And so that, I mean, just the reality. But anytime you can focus in on one level. Well, guys, for us, small groups is level 2. And that's our best place to help folks who are convinced but are not yet contagious contributors to get there. Does that make sense?
Yes.
And so that's the best place to do stewardship education. And so somebody was asking how often we do a stewardship series or whatever. You need to have a 4-week series on stewardship every year in your small groups. You just do. And there's some great resources for that. By the way, how many of you are familiar with the Treasure Principle by Randy Alcorn? Okay? Guys, that now is in a... Okay.
We bought cases of those.
Yes.
Online, and we were considering doing a series on that book.
Okay. Treasure Principle is, for those of you who don't know, is a, like a little Prayer of Jabez sized book. It's a 45-minute read. Mm-hmm. Let me tell you some ways that you can use it. One way that you can use it is that you can preach a series and give everyone a free copy in the congregation who comes during that series. Best money you'll ever spend. Mm-hmm. We did that years and years ago, and now here's what we do is every time we have a new members workshop, we give every family a copy of the Treasure Principle. So we gave it to the whole church 10 years ago, and now every new members workshop, you get a free copy. And I don't know what that would cost you to buy in bulk, but if you buy it by the case, it's going to probably be about $6. It's a pretty good investment, you know, when you think about what it does. And what we say to our people is that if you want to know what we believe about stewardship, read the Treasure Principle. Now, I would suggest that, as Randy Alcorn, I would suggest you read it before you hand it to your people to make sure that it expresses the theology. And if there's a nuance in it that's not right, you can always say, except for the part about so-and-so, which we believe this instead, you're going to find. But you can, I think it's a great resource to do there. They also now, Randy Alcorn actually has a 4 or 5 week, depending on how you do it, a 4 or 5 week small group study that's based on the Treasure Principle. And you don't have to have the book in order to do it. All you have to do is say, and let me just tell you this to help clarify for you. It's confusing because the 5 week study has the same title as the little book. And so what you have to do is go online and make sure you get the VIN number of the 5 week study versus the book itself. And you don't have to have the book to do the study. The 5 week study is a standalone. It's actually cheaper than the Treasure Principle. But if you haven't done recently a small group study, that is a great small group study, either 4 or 5 weeks, and it's got the leader's guide in the back of the even the booklets that you hand out. So everything you need is in the little booklet. But it's the Treasure Principle, and it's a good biblical study with lots of interaction and discussion that any small group ministry could do. But I think that's your best place. The other thing is for your small group leaders to be modeling stewardship, for you to help them understand it's important for them to talk about the fact they give and talk about why they give and talk about percentages that they give and talk about these three levels, giving something, giving a tithe, giving beyond threshold giving. I don't know about you guys, but we do not allow someone to be a small group leader unless they are at least at threshold giving, okay? And so, you know, you say, well, how do you know that? Well, you just set that standard and you say, you know, we expect people who are going to lead our small groups to be at least at threshold giving. Mm. And they just make the commitment that they're going to do that. And if that changes, that they'll come and talk to you about it. I had a guy one time that was being recruited to be a small group leader. And by the way, all of our small group leaders have to go before our board of elders and they have to be interviewed. And we do theological, they have to check off what their theology is, and they have to make a commitment to not do anything that would, in terms of their lifestyle, that would cause there to be suspect for the cause of Christ. We're not legalistic. We don't have a list of what those activities are, but we ask them to abstain from even the appearance of evil. Second thing is we ask for alignment from them. And by alignment, I mean that they would be loyal to the church and not lead a coup or a revolt. And, you know, we tell them that they're there to interpret so that if there are questions about the church, to come to the elders, to come to the staff and get answers to those questions, take it back to their people. And we're telling them, hey, guys, we're not asking you to rubber stamp everything that we do, but we are asking you to, you know, to say, hey, you know, I might not run the church like Pastor Steve ran the church if I was the pastor, but there's more going on right about our church than wrong, and so I think we ought to support. We can agree to disagree. It's not a test of fellowship. If it ever does become a test of fellowship, they make a commitment that they'll resign their role as a small group leader rather than to cause division in the church. But the third thing that we ask them to do is we ask them to give. Because wherever a man's treasure is, there his heart's also. Anyway, one time we were getting ready to recruit a guy, and we looked at his giving record, and it was non-existent. And so we, you know, this guy had talked a good game. He had teaching skills. He'd led a small group in the other church, you know. And so, his small group leader said that you need to have this guy as a small group leader. And So we sat down and talked to him and said, notice you're not giving anything. He said, well, and he started naming all these parachurch organizations that he gives to. And we said, well, we believe that your giving ought to begin in your home church. Mm-hmm. And you know what he said to me? He bowed up and he said, you have no right to tell me where I ought to be giving my money. That's a job for the Holy Spirit. And you know what I said to him? I said, I agree with you 100%. I have no right to tell you where you ought to be giving your money. That's the Holy Spirit's job. But you have no right to tell me who can be a small group leader in our church, because the Holy Spirit inspired the scriptures, and he said that wherever a man's treasure is, there his heart should be also. I'm not going to have somebody who's a leader in this church whose heart is not in this church. Okay? So you give wherever you want, but you're not going to be a leader in our church if you're not threshold giving to your church. Okay? So, guys, don't ever make the dumb statement to your church. Some of you have already made it. I don't know what any of our people give. Okay? All right? If you've made that to your church, go back and apologize to them and tell them that you're going to start looking. Okay?
That's right.
Because how can you pastor, how can you shepherd a group of folks that you don't know where their hearts are? And guys, they can talk a good game. They can carry their Bible up high.
Right.
But, guys, you know, where a man's treasure is, there's... How in the world are you going to know how to recruit leaders if you don't know? Now, here's what I hear, and this is hilarious to me. I hear people say, well, I'm afraid to look at the giving of our people because I'm afraid then that I'm going to be tempted to get close to the rich people and everything. Hey, guys, you already know who the rich people are. It has nothing to do. has nothing to do with their giving record. Those things don't even connect, okay? You know, if you're trying to get a free condo, you know, for your vacation, for your family, you already know who's driving the Mercedes, okay? You've already had lunch with them, okay? So that's a separate issue about the purity of your heart. And we'll talk a little bit more about that. But you are in the business of developing those who have the gift of giving, just like you're in the business of developing those who have the gift of leadership or the gift of teaching or anything else. And you don't ignore those folks. You don't treat them any better than anybody else, but you don't ignore those folks, okay? But all that to say, the small group is the best place, I think, to do stewardship education. Yes?
There's a new thought to me. I'll admit it. I've made the stupid statement.
All of us have at one time.
Okay.
Made the stupid statement.
Can I push back a little bit?
Please do.
What if I do that, but I have the treasurer and a few other people who, of course, they know all about the giving. And so when I'm asking someone to be a spiritual leader, I say to the treasurer, how's their giving? Is it roughly, you know, is it seen as though they're tithing and that kind of thing? That way I don't know exactly, but... Don't you think that temptation exists when we know how much people are giving to treat them differently?
Okay, the question is can I ask my treasurer to tell me if a church member I'm considering for leadership has a certain threshold so I know whether or not they qualify for that leadership position? And the answer to that is yes, you can do that, and that will solve that. But you also need to know who your large givers are from the standpoint of developing those even more. Just like you would want to know who's uniquely gifted in teaching and who's uniquely gifted in evangelism, who's uniquely given, you know, in leadership. And guys, I think the temptation to treat a wealthy person nicer for personal interest is what we ought to worry about. I don't think we ought to worry about the temptation to treat a wealthy person in a certain way because of what they can do for the church is a bad thing. You've got a resource. You want to maximize that resource. Yeah. You want to teach that person how to be a not only a generous giver, but an intelligent one. And I guarantee you, all the other organizations out there from the Cancer Society, the Heart Association, everything, they know who these people are, and they're pulling those resources. Now, here's my question is, do you think that the kingdom of God in the long run is more important than the Heart Society? Well, guys, they are working those people. You better be working them too, okay? And if you're not working them for your own personal interest, for your own personal gain, it's all right to know, and it's all right to treat them appropriately different. Now, we're not talking about what it talks about James, where you're giving them the first seat on the row and fawning over them, that type of thing. I'm talking about giving them attention in terms of guidance, in terms of directing their resources. That's the difference. That's a great question. Thank you for that. All right? Other questions or comments? Okay, let's talk about securing an annual commitment. We've already hit that pretty much, but every year we ask our people in January to recommit themselves to giving, to serving, to evangelism, all five of those things, having their own quiet time. And we do ask them for specifics for that. Now, you may be in a setting where that's too much of a cultural shift for you to go there right away. If so, then what I would encourage you to do is to secure an annual commitment that just checks a box that says, I commit myself to these five things. And don't ask for specifics, all right? Now, when we get those specifics, though, it is helpful to us, because if somebody checks a box that says, I will get involved in a small group, but they don't list a small group, what does that tell me about that person? They have intentions, but they have not yet found a small group. And so I turn that over to my small group people, and they can follow up on that person based on that affinity group that they might possibly be in. Somebody says, I'm committed to serve, but they don't list what team they serve with or what they do with their small groups. If you serve through your small groups, then I want to get their small group leader to know that they've made a commitment to serve so he can incorporate them in that, okay? Here's a fun thing. If they check that they're committing to pray for, seek to witness to, and invite these three lost people, you can take those names and give it to your prayer team and actually pray. Your prayer team can actually pray with that person for those folks that they're seeking to witness to. How powerful is that? Mm-hmm. And wouldn't it be wonderful if you took a handful of those every week and just set and prayed for them yourself and then sent them a note? And so they make this commitment in January. In March, they get a note from their pastor saying, I just want you to know that I prayed for you this morning as you're seeking to witness to Johnny B and Susie L and Edward P. Wouldn't that be powerful in terms of follow-up? We had a question over here. Yes.
Your small groups, do they run your ground straight through?
Ours do. That's not to say that that's what you need to do in your situation, but they do run year-round.
Repeat that question.
The question was, does our small groups run continually rather than in a semester format? I think there's a real value for the semester format, but if you were going to ask them to commit themselves to a small group, you just ask them to get in one in the next semester whenever they started back up. All right? Other questions at this point? All right, let's look at communicate clearly. When I say communicate clearly, what I'm saying is several things. One is I'm making it clear what I'm asking them to do, okay? Get very, very specific, the more specific. That's why when I preach a message, I like to say, some of you need to start giving, some of you need to start tithing, and some of you need to start moving beyond the tithe. What specifically are we asking them to do? Also, when the vision is clear, people give to a clear vision. We've been in, as Nelson said, we've been in 9 capital campaigns in 30 years. And we get real, real specific about what those capital campaigns are going to accomplish. For example, the last capital campaign that we were in, we gave 20% of it to missions. And we didn't just say missions, we said that 20% is going to go, first of all, to start 4 new churches in the continental United States. And we're going to start one in San Francisco. We're going to start one in San Diego. And told that we're going to invest $150,000. It was $600,000 of our capital campaign is going to be invested, $150,000 each, to churches in those cities. Well, now all of a sudden it becomes concrete for somebody instead of saying, give money to missions, whatever that means. You see what I'm saying? And then for the capital campaign part of it, 70% of it was going to capital campaigns. That was going to provide a satellite campus for us, and it was going to include a $1 million upgrade at an existing or expansion at an existing campus. And we shared those things. So you get clear about where their money is going to and what you're asking them to do to participate in that. And so clarity allows people to respond more boldly, okay? Look at the next sheet there. The D is cultivate key givers. All right, back to the question about knowing what people give. On a regular basis, in my setting, and your setting will be different, but for my setting, about twice a week, I have a meal with a key donor, either a breakfast or a lunch. And it's a catalytic system in this sense, in that my administrative assistant is just setting those up. I don't have to think about them. And basically, there's a threshold above which, if someone hits that threshold of their annual giving, I set up a lunch for them. And Sandra will call them up and she'll say, hey, the pastor's having lunch with some church members, want to know if they could have lunch with you and get to know you a little bit better. Are you available? And by the way, he would love to have your spouse join you if that's convenient for her. I would never meet with a woman by myself for lunch. I would love to meet with a couple, but I'm not going to let the need to meet with a couple keep me from meeting with the man. So that's kind of how that's set up. And again, that's just the way we're doing it. I'm not saying that's how you have to do it. And so then when I meet with that person, what I want to do is I want to meet with them. And before I go, I get a little card from Sandra, and it has a number on it with a K after it. Okay, anybody figure out what that means, okay? And that's going to show me the level at which they gave in the last 12-month period. It's going to have the name of their spouse, the name of their kids. It's going to tell me if they are actively involved in a small group, okay? It's going to tell me if they're serving somewhere in the church, okay? And then any other information that might, you know, be necessary for me. So I'm going to sit down and lunch with that person, and I'm going to say, hey, listen, no agenda today except just to get to know you and encourage you in your involvement in the church. Tell me what's going on. And we talk, we'll find out about their family, find out about what's going on, find out how long they've been going to the church. But there's some key questions I want to ask. I want to ask, is there any way that our church can do a better job of helping you grow in Christ? Okay, is there any way we can do a better job? Second question I'm going to ask is, I'm going to ask, do you have any questions about where our church is going, or anything that's going on in our church? So questions. Why am I doing that? Because if they have a question about our vision or our direction or our purpose, it's going to affect their giving. Mm-hmm. Okay? I'm going to, if I notice they're not in a small group, I'm going to help them before I leave for lunch to get involved in a small group, because people stay in churches longer where they're connected in relationships. Okay? And then I'm going to find out if they're serving anywhere. If they're not serving anywhere, I'm going to help them consider some places to serve, because what we found out is that people give who are serving in the church give more money, okay? Not to mention the fact that they're being disobedient to God and they would be blessed if they were serving somewhere. So I'm going to deal with all of that. And then I'm going to, if they are a regular giver and if it's obvious that they've been giving over a long period of time, I'm going to thank them for their financial support of the church and the difference that it's going to make. And I'm probably going to tell them a story of a life that was changed before I leave. And then I'm going to close that lunch by saying, is there any way that I can pray for you? And I'm going to take their prayer request and I'm going to add it to my permanent list of folks that I pray for, so that when I meet with them again next year, I can say, how's it going with your mother-in-law? Okay? Because that was the prayer request. You know, that God would somehow change my irregular mother-in-law to a normal person. And so I've been praying for them for a year about that. And they're going to know that I actually kept my commitment to pray for them. Okay? Now, that's a wonderful thing. You notice that I didn't ask them for money anytime during that thing, because that wasn't the purpose. The purpose was to help them in their small group involvement, to help them find a place of service. And by the way, guys, here's an added benefit from this. When I asked the question, is there any way that we can do a better job of ministering to you and your family, help you better grow in Christ, there's always, it's a form of dipping down into your organization and find out what's not working. Mm-hmm. And they will be honest to you. Bill Hybels did an interview with a fairly wealthy man at one of the leadership summits, and they were taking questions in that particular session. And one of the questions was, what would you say to those of us who are pastors of churches who are trying to raise money from more wealthy people? What would you say? And quickly, just like that, he said, you know, it's interesting. What I would say to you is ask these people's opinion about how to do ministry. He said, people always come into us, ask for money, but nobody ever asks us for our input in the church. But when I say, is there a better way that we can minister to you and your family, that's what I'm asking. What's not working as well as it could be working in our church? So I want to say, what can we do to better minister to you and your family? How can I pray for you? And then I want to help them get involved in small group and help them get involved in service. And guys, I do that year-round. I don't do that just when there's a capital campaign, okay? And the only thing that changes on the year that we're having a capital campaign is when I get to that question, do you have any questions about where our church is going or why we do what we do or that type of thing? Usually because there's a buzz about whatever the next capital campaign is, they'll bring up that topic. And when they do bring up that topic, I'll say, well, you know, we're building a new children's building, or we're doing this new missions initiative that we're doing this capital campaign for. And then I just say, you know, John, I just want you to know that we're counting on you to be a part of this. And I'm going to ask you to prayerfully consider giving the largest gift that you've ever given to any charitable organization when we have this campaign. And I will include that statement related to the upcoming campaign on the years that we're having a capital campaign. But that means I've met with them for two times before I've made that statement. And that's the only time I make an ask. And by the way, even during a capital campaign, this is just me, guys, I don't ask for a specific amount from somebody. Mm-hmm. I just don't do it. Because why would I ask for $50,000 when the guy wants to give me $200,000? Why would I do that? Mm-hmm. I think the Holy Spirit does a better job asking for specific amounts than I do. And so I asked them not even to give the largest gift. I've asked them to pray about the possibility of giving the largest gift that they've ever given. And I let the Holy Spirit set the strike point, okay? So I remember one time I met with a guy, and we had lunch, and, you know, we're having lunch and everything. And he says, okay, Pastor, how much money do you need? Because every other relationship he has as a wealthy person is somebody having lunch with him asking for money. And I said, you know, we always need money at the church, but I didn't come to ask you for money. I just came to fellowship with you today. And he kind of relaxed and enjoyed the rest of the lunch. And so you can't do that if you're not meeting with these guys on a regular basis and you're not trying to help them move along on their own spiritual pilgrimage, okay? Yes?
A and B. A, I know you mentioned this. You do this every day. How often are you meeting with folks?
Okay, the question is, how often do I meet with folks? This is, I have two meals a week.
Two a week.
Okay. So I may have a breakfast on a Wednesday, and I may have a lunch on a Friday with a key donor. And Sandra just says, you know, I said, what does my day look like? And she says, blah, 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 and you got a key donor lunch. So.
In your mind, Steve, what's the threshold for a key giver?
Guys, the question is, what's the threshold for a key giver? It's going to be different in every situation. All I can do is tell you what I do. Anything over $10,000 annually for me hits that threshold. That's in our context. Okay, so it is, but that doesn't mean that that's the threshold for you guys. I'm just telling you that's the way we do it. That basically means that somebody is making at least $100,000 a year and tithing. You say, oh gosh, there wouldn't be enough lunches and breakfasts for me to hit everybody that's making $100,000 that's giving 10%. I think you're going to find out you're not going to have that many meals that you're going to have to go to. Yeah, and you may be in a place where you have to set that threshold at 15,000. I don't know.
I had a question.
Yes.
Did you never meet with a woman alone?
Yeah.
A single woman is one of your key donors.
Yeah, and I probably need, the question is, what if one of your key givers, your key donors, is a woman, and yet you got this dilemma where you never meet with her alone? That's just a dilemma of two principles that I have. One principle is I ought to develop leaders and donors, and there's a lady who needs that development. My dilemma there is also have another value, is that I want to abstain from even the appearance of evil. And so I've got those two working against each other, and so I've chosen the lesser of two evils there at that point. Yeah, and you could take her somebody with you. I can refine that system. That's just the way that up to this point. I'm just being honest about what I do. Okay, but yeah, the better thing, like Nelson is suggesting, is that I take somebody with me in that situation. I just have not done that yet, is the short answer. Okay. Great question, though. Thank you for that. And there are other ways that I do develop leaders other than that. I wrote had a lady walk up to me this Sunday who said, thank you for that note. And then what she was referring to is because she hit a certain threshold and she's a single lady. In her giving, I wrote her a long personal note that's thanking her for investing in the lives of other people and for her faithfulness and her generosity. And so I developed her in a little different way in that situation. But yeah, that's a deficit in that system that could be refined. Yes?
What do you do with somebody who's coming and you know they're wealthy, but they're not giving? They're not in that. Do you have lunches with them or not?
Yeah, the question is, what if you know that there's somebody who's coming to your church and they're wealthy, but they're not giving? Do you have breakfasts or lunches with them? And the answer to that is yes. They get on that list. Now, in a church our size, we'll have about 11,000 people on a given weekend. It's harder for me to see those people. Sometimes they're around for a long time before I see them. But yeah, they get on that list if I see that they have that potential, but they're not reaching that potential. Great question. Also, in terms of cultivating the key givers and cultivating the regular givers, which is our next point there, is I also write a personal note, as I just referred to this single lady that example that I gave you. I write a personal note to anybody who gives a singular gift over a certain amount. And my assistant keeps a record of who I write those notes to so that I don't write a note every time they make the gift. But at least once a year, you're going to get a handwritten note from me if you give a singular gift over a certain amount. And then at the end of the year, everybody who gives over a certain threshold, and that threshold is lower, it's not $10,000, it's $3,000 or above, I'm going to send some type of gift and a letter of appreciation to those people. Okay? Now, the gift might be the treasure principle. The gift might be a DVD of Change Lives that year. The gift might be a book that on spiritual growth that has nothing to do with stewardship or giving. Just to say, hey, you're one of our faithful givers, and we appreciate that. I want to just send this gift as a token of our appreciation, but more than that, to acknowledge you as, you know, that kind of person. So that's an annual thing. So if a person's a regular giver and then they're high caliber or a key donor, they're going to have a meal with me a year, they're going to get a handwritten note from me, and they're going to get an end-of-the-year gift. If they're not one of the larger givers, they're going to get a gift at the end of the year with a letter from me, and obviously hand-signed letter from me, and then they're going to get a note from me sometime, perhaps during the year, if they've got a larger gift. And for me, that gift is $1,500 in one check or more. $3,000 is the strike point for the annual gift, and then $10,000 is the strike point for the lunch. But that's a relative thing. Yes, sir. Okay, the question is, how do you deal with the criticism that you only pay attention to those who give? Well, first of all, the people who are not giving don't know that I'm giving this attention, okay? I've only been criticized once by those who have been getting the attention. I had an attorney say to me, I feel a little uncomfortable with you having lunch with me because I'm a larger giver. And I said, well, I'm sorry you feel that way. If it makes you feel better, I also have lunches with people who have leadership gift and teaching gift and everything else. I decided not to treat you any differently than the rest of our church members. And he's still in the church, still giving, but he was the only one to ever express that. You realize that most time I have lunch with people, I don't ever mention their giving, okay? And so they don't necessarily know that I'm having lunch with them. In fact, I've had people say this. I thought it was real surprising when I got the phone call from you. I thought maybe I was in trouble or something. That a pastor in a church our size would have time to have lunch. And I said, well, you know what? I found it's very, very helpful to talk with folks and find out what's going on out there. And I obviously can't have lunch with everyone, but I always appreciate having lunch with folks and getting to know them. And also, it gives me a chance to affirm some of those who are supporting our church. So there's a nuance of why I'm there, but it's not directly, I'm having lunch with you because you hit the 10,000 strike point. And by the way, if you want lunch next year, you better keep on giving. Yes, sir.
Do you let them pick up the tab?
No, I always pick up the tab. And I say always. I've got two guys who under no circumstances in the world would ever let me pick up the tab. But what I do, and I do this thing here, I always say to them, I ask you to lunch. I'm paying for lunch today, but here's the deal. Next time we have lunch, you can pick it up. And so the second time I have lunch with that person, if they remember, and some of them do, they pick up the lunch and I let them pick it up, and then I pick it up the next time. Okay? And guys, this is also a biblical principle. If you remember the parable of the unjust steward, who when he found out he was going to be fired, he went out and he forgave all these debts so that when he was out of a job, they would be indebted to him. Think about it. If you paid for all these lunches and you get fired from your church, you've got about 200 or 300 lunches out there that may keep you alive. Now, there's also a phrase I use, and I don't use it very often because some people don't have the same humor that I have, is that they said, no, let me pick it up. And I said, no, let me pick it up. And then as I signed the deal, I said, your tithe dollars at work. Okay? But you got to be careful. Some people don't have that same kind of humor. Yes.
How are you cultivating, in a multiple step,
Nobody else is having lunch, although every once in a while I will take a staff member with me on these lunches because of the dynamics that are involved there. And we're not talking about private things, obviously. I've called the lunch. I would never invite a staff member into a lunch if somebody's asked me to have lunch, but since I initiated, I will bring a staff with me. But and part of the reason I'm not having, the question is, do you ever have other staff members do this? And the reason I don't is because I go back to principle, guys, if you're the pastor of the church, you have got to be the primary fundraiser. They want to see the manager. They do. And so I don't think you can delegate this. I got a church where I got 11,000 people showing up on the weekend. Am I hitting the same ratio of larger givers that I used to when we were a smaller church? No, I'm not. But I just don't think you can hand this thing off. And very frankly, my weight won't stand more than two donor lunches a week. Yeah, I'm working on that. Yes, sir. It's a great question. Every time I do these things, I learn things. What about a multi-site? Would the same thing happen? And I haven't ever thought about that. But it's possible. It's possible that you could get away with donor development by the campus pastor. Here's part of the problem in that, just thinking about it fresh, never thought about it before, is that I'm teaching, even at the multi-site, I'm the pastor. I'm the one who's leading through my preaching. The reason we don't have our multi-sites preach more than they do, which is either two or three times a year to lift up the value that that particular campus needs to lift up, is that if somebody is preaching all the time, he's leading. And if he leads, you're going to end up with five different churches instead of five different campuses. They're just going to become, and if you want to do that with them, that's a great way to plant churches by multi-campus. But because of that aspect of it, I'm not sure I can delegate that to that person, because the person they're getting their primary teaching from is the person they want to have lunch with. That's a great question, though. Something I need to think about. Yes, sir.
So you're sending, you're handwriting several thousand notes a year.
Yes, sir. It's you know what? We underestimate what we can get accomplished over a long period of time. Just do some every day. I used to write birthday cards to all of my church members, and there came a point where I couldn't do that anymore. So now I write birthday cards only to staff members, and that takes a while. But that's a great use of your time, and you can do that while you're doing other things, especially if you're writing the same thing every time. Yeah. Just figure out what you can do and do that much. All right? Okay. Nelson has some great material, and and some of you have heard it before. Maybe when we have a break or something, before the break, he can talk about what he does to first-time givers and that type of things, in terms of a catalytic system by which you recognize people's moving from one level to the next, and you use that in the catalytic system, so even when you're not thinking about it, those kind of things happen. Okay, let's talk about maximizing giving. I think the primary way that you maximize giving is you recognize the fact that there are at least five different pockets. This concept was first, I think, broached by Maxwell years and years ago. But it's something that we live by, and that is that there's five different pockets. And to use very crass language is that you need to pick all five pockets every year, okay? You understand the spirit in which I say that. Blessing your folks. Number one is the general pocket. General pocket is basically given by your folks who are your rule keepers, your builders especially who are in church, the builder generation. They would give to the church, pay the light bill, pay the insurance, and they didn't have to know what it was going for or be inspired or anything else. It was just they were rule keepers and they did it. And you've still got some folks, even younger folks, who are rule keepers who will give to the general fund. And it helps from time to time for you to let them know what that money goes to. They're not interested in Excel spreadsheet with the numbers. What they want to know is story of changed lives. And so when I do a new members workshop, I say, you know, general budget, that, you know, pays for the light bill, that pays for insurance, that pays for the chair that you're sitting in, that, you know, pays for the buses where our kids go to camp, and I name some stuff. You want to collect that, and obviously you want to collect that every week, and there's all different kinds of ways. Obviously, one of the ways that's become very, very popular is online giving right now. And again, you want to make it real, real clear if somebody wants to give online, how to give online. You want to make it very easy for them to give online. One of the things that we do is we have an offering envelope. It's got a place for their name, and then it's got a place for them to give to the general, to the building, and to missions. And I'll say a little bit more about this later, but online, if they come online, they can give to those same three funds or they can give to others. We have a kiosk in our main foyer where they can use their debit cards or they can use credit cards to give right there at that kiosk for those who don't carry cash with them and don't carry checkbooks. And these offering envelopes, I'm jumping ahead of myself a little bit, but let's go ahead and do it. These offering envelopes, we have an offering envelope service that sends those offering envelopes to their homes once a month. And they're going to get three of these, and they're also going to get an envelope with the church address on it and a postage paid envelope. So they can take their offering envelope and they can slip it into that postage paid return envelopes, and we get hundreds of those back every week, hundreds and hundreds of them. So we're making it easy. Now what we have done is recently we've asked people who for years have been getting their monthly envelopes if they would rather get an email reminder of giving online. And so now what we do is we send an email to them with a link to our online giving, and so once a month they're getting a reminder. And in that, now we're asking in our new members workshop, would you rather get the envelope sent to you for your convenience, or would you rather get an email sent to you with a link to online giving? And so we're moving away from snail mail simply because so many of our people have moved to that. Now, we don't have as high of a percentage of folks who are giving online as a lot of churches, but I think our giving online will increase now that we're giving people the option of doing one or the other. And at the new members workshop, they also receive a form where they can go ahead and fill out to do the automatic withdrawal and turn that in right at the new members workshop as well. So we also are now doing an annual mailing of that same form where they can have the automatic deduct. Okay, but we're only at, right now, we're only at, to go ahead and answer the question that will be asked, we're only at about 11% on our line giving, which is real, real low considering other churches that I know. But we're moving more to that, but we're making it easy for folks to give to the general budget. Okay? Yes?
Do you do any kind of a survey to find out, like, how many people in your church are doing online banking to make that more convenient, or did you just move that way on?
We just move that way because it's obviously the way that a lot of people are. Well, you know anecdotally that a lot of your people are paying their bills online and everything else. And so some of them would do it if they knew how to do it. And what you need to do is just tell them how to do it and make it very, very easy for them. Okay? Let's look at the second pocket. The second pocket is the building fund. Guys, there are people who will give to your building fund who have never given to general and who will never give to general. All right? One of the great things about having a capital campaign back to back for nine different times is that we discover new givers all the time to our capital campaign who've never given to the general fund. There's just something about some folks, just the way they're wired. They like to see brick, they like to see mortar, they like to see something come up out of the ground, okay? And so we want to give them a chance to give. And here's what we've also found is that people will start giving to the building fund and then turn around and start giving to the general fund for the first time. But the first fund they ever gave to marijuana is a gateway drug. Their gateway drug for giving is building fund for them to start giving to the general fund. So now, I can't imagine a church not having a building fund. If you don't have a building fund, basically you're saying I can't imagine. If you're in a situation where you would never build, you might not have a building fund. But if you're not in a situation like that where you would never build, you're basically saying to your people, we're not going to grow. I mean, even if you're not doing a capital campaign, there ought to be some slot that says building fund unless you have a strategy that includes never having a building. Yes, sir.
I was just about to say, this church,
right,
I believe, and the church that I work with,
yes,
probably won't.
Yeah, the question is, the statement is, there are churches who will never have a building. Yeah. For those folks, are the only people in the world that I would consider it making sense for them not having a slot that says building fund.
So So could there be a capital campaign for something other
than... Oh, my goodness. Yes. Oh, my goodness. Yes.
Like church planting or yes. building virtual building funds.
Yeah. The question is... question. Yeah, the question is would you ever have a capital campaign for something other than a building? And my goal is for us eventually to manage our buildings in such a way in multiplication that there will come a time where we have a capital campaign that is completely non-building. Now, we're moving there. As I shared with you, had 20% of our last capital campaign went to missions, 10% of it went to new initiatives, only 70% went to facilities. That was our last one. And so, yeah, very much so. But unless you're in a strategy or you're in an environment where you cannot own facilities, I would have a building fund. I would have one. Even if you don't have a drawing of the next building. Now, that's not the same thing as having a capital campaign. You're just having a building fund. And every once in a while you say, guys, you know, we don't have a building that we're building right now, but you know in the future we will need that. You don't even have to say anything. Just put the blank there. Guys, there are some of your obsessive, compulsive people who will put money in the building fund slot just because it's on the envelope, okay? And so you don't want to leave that money on the table. And guys, I don't know about y'all, but I've come from a church that most of our 30-year history, we were basically just barely economically above blue collar. I didn't have folks who could write large checks. And if I don't get $30 from that family every month over a period of 10 years, I'm not going to get any substantial gift from that family. So I have to collect building fund, you know, 365 days a year, every year, or we're not going to be able to provide the facilities that we need. We just are, because I can't live by that big gift. And so I want to give them our people day in and day out. Folks who've joined our church since our last capital campaign, okay? They're giving to the building fund, and they don't even know what they're giving to. They're just, it's there. They're writing money, and they're putting it in there because they know, they look around, there's buildings. So they must need building fund, okay? All right, third fund is the designated fund. There's some of you who are scared to death of the designated fund because you're afraid the inmates are going to control the prison, okay? Don't be afraid of the, in fact, I want you to add a word above designated. I want to ask you to add the word directed designated giving. Directed designated giving. What we do is we have a financial newsletter that we send out quarterly, and it's not expensive. It's black and white. It's just included in there. When we send out the information about how much they've given this quarter, send out the quarterly donation, we include that financial newsletter, and in it, it tells that we're audited. It tells a story about a life that's been changed because of their giving. Talks about where we are in our projects for our last capital campaign and how we've been using that money. And then it always has a list of designated items that they can give to. And it goes from $50 to $50,000, usually about 14 items, okay? Everything from a $50 leather-bound study Bible, which is what we give new Christians who join our church and are brand new Christians, to a 21-passenger van. And they're included there. Now think about it, guys. You got a guy who's in your church who's in IT. So he understands the value of technology. He also has two kids in your youth department. And you put on there that you need a laptop computer for the youth division, and he will write you a check for $1,500 that he would never write to the general fund. He will. And you put that you need two, he'll write you a check for $3,000. Put them in there. And these are things that you would buy anyway. It may even be things that are in the budget. And so if he buys those two computers for $3,000, that means you're going to have a $3,000 surplus at the end of the year that you can apply to your debt or something else. You hear what I'm saying? Or give for camp scholarships. Or something you wanted to put in the budget this year, but because you did a good job of projecting, you realized that was unrealistic for you to put that in your budget, so you put that in there. Yes.
How often do you send
this? I send out quarterly. And it's with your quarterly financial statements. We send out quarterly financial statements so that people will know what they've given to date, because people always think they give more to your church than they're actually giving. They're thinking the wife's handling it, and she's thinking the husband's handling it. And so you send out, and we send out a giving statement to every church member over the age of 21, and it's got what they've given to date. And guys, you need to look at it, because some of your computer programs are doing it in a way that's so confusing they can't read it. This last one that I did I actually, because we've got some complications about some things and offerings we've taken and everything else, I actually included an explanation sheet how to read your contribution form. I did, with arrows and everything on it, because I had feedback from our people. When I asked the question with that large donor, you know, is there any way about better ministry, any question about insurance? She said, I can't read my contribution statement. And I said, well, let's talk about that. And so I looked at them, and it was confusing the way the computer was printing them out. And so now there's a guide, there's a key to how to read your contribution statement. But we include that financial newsletter in with the contribution statements. And so we've got that list, and it tells you who to contact. It also tells you how to give online in there, that type of thing. Now, funny story. For years, we put this 21-passenger van in the deal. At that time, it was $40,000 for a 21-passenger van. After it being in there for 10 years, I had a guy, I'm going to go ahead and use his name, Ken Jones, came to our church, and he had just sold some Walmart stock for $400,000 profit is what his profit was. And he had a check for $40,000, and he said, I need to see the pastor today. Came in there, stomped in, and he took his check, and he said, this is $40,000 for that blasted 21-passenger van. He said, get it off of the list. That just drip, drip, drip for 10 years. He had seen that listed 40 times. 40 times. Now, guys, every time I listed it, I earned $1,000. $1,000. That's pretty good. That's pretty good return for your investment, don't you think? Okay. So take that designated. Guys, hey, here's the other deal. You can always turn down a designated gift. I had a lady who wanted to give, in honor of her late husband, wanted to give a flagpole to sit in front of our church. And I turned it down. In fact, it's the only designated gift I can think of that I've ever turned down. But I turned it down. I said, now, if you want to give that money we're about to build a new baptismal fount. And if you want to give that money toward that, I'm happy to do that. But we don't need a flagpole. So you can always turn it down. So don't worry about that. But there are people who want to designate their gift. They want to give toward their passion, okay? And guys, we're not talking about them putting their name on it or anything like this. It's not an ego thing. It's just the way God wired them. They have a passion for something, and they want to give toward it. Let them give toward it, okay? Fourth thing is benevolence. Because you've got folks with a mercy gift, because you've got people that God has just wired them that way, they're going to want to give to benevolence. Let me tell you how we take a benevolence offering. We take one benevolence offering a year. I'm not saying this is how you ought to do it. I'm just saying this is how we do it. We take it on Christmas Eve. And what I do is I stand up during Christmas Eve. We have a candlelight service. Last year we had 22,000 people show up for a candlelight service. And guys, I take that offering with more aggressiveness than I take any offering all year long. Because I tell them that 100% of what they give is going to go outside of this church. It's going to provide job training. It's going to provide utility bills. It's going to provide counseling. We gave away $120,000 worth of free counseling last year. And I push that offering hard, and I say, I want you to give generously. And by the way, if you're a guest with us today, usually we ask you not to give. If you're a guest with us today, I want you to feel free to give, because what you're going to do is you're going to make an impact on this community. And 100% of that offering goes toward that. And so this last Christmas Eve, we took up a one-time offering of $400,000 for benevolence. Now, what that means is you can take that out of your general fund, see? And whatever you were budgeting for benevolence now is set free for that. I'm able to say this to our people every year. Because of your generosity last Christmas Eve, we were able to say yes to every legitimate benevolent request that we had come in. And your people love to give that. You'll have people who are lost who will be at that Christmas Eve service who will think higher of your church because you took that offering and will write a $1,000 check. And you can take that check from them. It's legal. It's okay. All right? Okay. So take that every year. Here's what I want to warn you, though. The way you do benevolence is somebody's house burns down, you take up an offering. Somebody loses their job, you take up an offering. And what happens is you nickel and dime yourselves to death, and your people, their eyes roll up in their head every time there's a need. Mm-hmm. Take up one offering once a year, and then tell them when that house burns down, because of your generosity at Christmas Eve, we're able to help that family who's... Because of that fireman who died in the fighting the fire, because you gave to the benevolence offering last Christmas Eve, we're able to help him. We wanted to know you. We just had this hurricane down here, and we were able to send money to three different churches and also to fund our disaster relief unit that went down there because of the money you gave at Christmas Eve. Don't nickel and dime yourself to death on those things. Take that benevolence offering once a year. Okay? Yes, sir.
We do that on our envelope. The benevolence on our envelope, so we get it every mm-hmm. week, and it's like $30,000 a year for us. It just sort of keeps coming in. People love hearing the stories.
Okay. The statement is that they put benevolence on their envelope. What we've chosen to do is to put missions and building there and do the Christmas time on the benevolence, but you can do it exactly the same way because the fact that it's there, I never say anything about this missions. I never say anything about that building thing being on there. It takes up the offering for itself without nickel and diming yourself. You're actually taking up a benevolence offering weekly at your church, mm-hmm. but it's not wearing your people out. It's just right. the opportunity that's always there. Now, I will caution you to be careful not to put very many on your envelope, on your regular envelope. You may choose to do, say, benevolence instead of building, or you may choose to do benevolence instead of missions on your envelope. If you put six options on your envelope, they ignore all of them. Probably needs three at the most, four is my sense, and that's more intuitive than anything else. Okay, yes, sir.
Do you always consider the building category to be the next thing, or do you use building resources to retire debt on something you've just built?
Great. The question is, when you have building on your envelope, do you consider that for your next project or would you consider using it for debt? When they say building, what they've done is they've given us permission to use it for facilities any way we want. We could replace an air conditioning unit that's gone out that cost us $25,000. We can retire debt with it or we can apply it to the next project. Or if we're having a tough financial year, we can supplement our annual building payments. In a year, what that does is that provide margin for you in a tough year when you don't make budget. So when they put it in building, I can use it any way I want as long as it's for buildings. Okay, great question. Yes, sir.
Steve, I was curious about your focus at Christmas on the benevolence.
Yes.
The reason is that in our church, we get a huge bump in December of the giving.
Yes.
And I'm wondering if you do that, whether you're kind of undercutting.
Great question. The question is, we get a big bump from our general giving in December, and I'm wondering if you take your benevolent offering in December, are you losing some of that money going over? And my response would be that to that, very little crossover. And the reason is these are five separate pockets. It's hard to believe this. It's fear sets in for us. But guys, I know guys who don't push missions hard because they're afraid it's going to hurt their general fund. Guys, it doesn't hurt. In fact, I think there's a bigger bump on cross-pollinization of giving when you're taking all five offerings every year. Mm-hmm. And so to my short answer to the question, does it hurt your end of the year giving? I don't think so. And it doesn't certainly hurt it as much as we benefit from the additional money that we have to do benevolent and compassion ministry, okay? It's really a different pocket. It's hard to believe, but it really is. Yes. Here's the question. The question is, by limiting the offering envelope to only three choices, where does a person have the opportunity to make their designated offerings? And also kind of a follow-up, do you ever take up an offering for youth or children? The reason I only have three things on my offering envelope, I've got general, missions, and building, is because I take the designated offering with this quarterly newsletter. Somehow, I mean, I don't have a vehicle for them to get back to me except that on the online giving, there is a slot that says other that they can put in there. But typically what happens on that designated giving is they call up the church office and they say, hey, I would like to give that. And our financial secretary says, well, just put it in a regular envelope and put on there designated for the youth computers. Or they come by my office and say, I've got a check for the... Somehow those designated gifts get to us without us providing a slot on there. Because what does other mean? You know?
Some people have a passion for children's ministry. Is that a pocket? Is that, you know, some people might say, I'd like to give...
Yeah, the question is, some people have a passion for children's ministry. Is that a pocket? Here's what happens, is that we have designated accounts in our budget. And there are people who make designated accounts, gifts to the children's ministry. They make designated gifts to the library. They make designated gifts to a lot of different things. And when they do, we accept it and we put it in that designated. But I don't solicit that because the general fund services those things.
Right.
And it's kind of like keeping it to three things on the envelope. If I start doing I'm really asking for designated giving because on my designated giving, I ask for two computers for the youth area. And there's a stainless steel baby bed on there for the children's area. So there is already an opportunity for you to give to the youth and children, but it is directed. Now, do we have some unsolicited stuff coming in? Yes. Do we accept it? Yes. But we forbid our age group and other staff members from raising their own budget. Now, that's when the inmates start running the prison, okay? And at that positive note, we're going to take a break.
All right, hang on just one second, guys. Before you head out, I'll give you some instructions. I was just looking over your notes, and most of you have written books so far. If you could see your notes, how many of you have at least one idea that you're going to go back that you think is going to make a big difference in your church? Let me see your hand. All right, at least five ideas, 10 ideas. All right, that's me. I'm in the 10-idea deal. So you can see why we asked Steve to do this and why he brought it in. A couple of things you might want to jot down in your notes. This is where you get the treasure principle, so thanks, Michael, for this. Maninthemirror.org. If you go to that website and you click on Books by the Box, so M-A-N-I-N, the mirror, M-I-R-R-O-R.org, you can buy a case of the treasure principle books. You can get 48 of them for $134. So whatever that works out to, it's like
$3
a piece or something like that. So that's a great deal.
Can't afford not to buy
that. If you don't mind, since your credit card number's up not on this.
Nice.
So that credit card number is 500. And so anyway, I'll lay that right here on this front table. Thanks. You see that? Steve's book. We have about 6 copies of this left. Money Matters in Church. And some of this, what you talked about, is in here, and some sample forms that he's talked about is in here, but then a lot of other material that he's not getting to today is in here, plus an overview of his theory about capital campaigns is in this book. They're $14 on Amazon. He brought some with him. They're $10 back at the resource table. You can buy it on the Church Leader Insights resource form with that. If you missed that today, I will be sending next week a follow-up email to you thanking you for coming, giving you a link to Steve's website, some other resources. I'll also link to this book on Amazon.com, or you can have your bookstore order it, but $10 is cheaper than you can get it anywhere else. Cheaper than I'd sell it, those of you who know my resources. So, But I do have some of my resources here that are on special. I'm not traveling this summer doing any seminars. So what we have back here is we basically have leftover stock from all of my live events. And so if I went and did it, if I conducted an event but I didn't sell everything, you know, we shipped it back here, and now it's here at our office, and we're either going to have to send it back to the company or something like that. So I thought we'd bring out what we have left over and offer it to you at a significant discount. So for example, my stewardship seminar, the basic seminar that Steve was talking about, those of you that are in coaching, how many of you have been through my coaching networks? Let me see your hands. Yeah, most of you. You've already got this, so you don't need to buy this. But if you're not in my coaching network and you don't have this, this sells on the website for $89, so basically $90. And we're going to offer it today for $30. And so it just keeps us from having to package it up, change all the labels on the back and all this kind of stuff. And you can even see that in live events, we sell it for $67. So it's $89 on the website, $67 at live events. You can get it for $30. I've got like 5 copies left over. Since most of you have been through my coaching networks, you may say, well, you know, do you have any resources that I don't have? So let me highlight a couple of these. One is that features Steve. That he may not even know about. This one's called Leadership Skills for a Growing Church. I've been privileged over the last 10 or so years in ministry to have an opportunity to hang out with guys like Steve, with guys like Rick Warren, with Larry Osborne, and some other high-capacity leaders. And you guys in coaching always ask me, what do these guys have in common? Like, you know, as a guy that leads a 12,000-person church or a 20,000-person church, what do they have in common that, you know, the rest of us don't know? So I started asking that question. And what I identified is there's about 6 skill sets that most of these high-capacity leaders have that we can all learn. And so I did this seminar, and some of you were here maybe when I did this live, but it was called Leadership Skills for a Growing Church, and it's 6 secret skills that every church leader can develop, but it's skills that you don't learn in seminary or you don't always learn in a day-to-day. So this is a popular resource when I travel. It's normally, again, $89, but we have about 5 copies for $30 if you want. It talks about how to keep growing as a leader, how to manage ever-increasing time demands, how to maximize staff and volunteers, how to anticipate the future. That sounds familiar. That's the one I stole from you. And then how to reproduce other leaders. So it's kind of like all a summary of what I've learned with some of these guys I've had a chance to hang out with. And then my time management resource. I read about 70-something books on time management over the last 10 years, and I took the top 34 principles from those books that apply to ministry. And this is a resource called Time Management for Busy Pastors. And so if you're looking to have another hour, you say, where do I get an hour to have that lunch with the big donor? Or how do I find time to write those letters that Steve's talking about? Or just to think about, you know, some of these things that you need to think about. Well, I put each of these 34 in here because I believe they would save you at least an hour a month. So this resource is designed to give you 34 hours in your month that maybe you don't have right now. And I've gotten great feedback on that. We just have a handful of these. They're back there as well. This is only $30. And then all my single CDs, normally $30, they're only $10. And all the sermon series, which are normally $90 to $100, they're $40. So if you want to pick those up, it's a great opportunity to do that. And then Steve has another resource that I wanted to mention to you, that we have four of these back there. Well, four counting this one here. A few months ago, he did an event, an all-day event at his church where he brought leaders together who were thinking about going through a capital campaign. Do any of you think you might have a capital campaign in your future? Let me see your hands. Okay, a couple things you might. One is Steve does capital campaign consulting. If you're interested in that, you can let me know or let him know while he's here. But he brought a group of pastors together, I believe it was about 50 pastors, and they paid over $1,000 plus travel and all of that to come spend a day with him, and he taught them everything that he knows about how to lead your On Capital campaign. And they received this plus a 99-page booklet. And some of the booklet is the fill-in-the-blank part, but then a lot of it was all the letters that he uses in a capital campaign, all the resources, all the cards, all the printouts, all the sermons, and everything like that. So it was an entire process on how to lead your On Capital campaign. And then that's been taken and put together in a four DVD set plus a notebook. And so you get all of that. And we are going to start carrying this resource at Church Leader Insights. And because of our network and all of that, what's normally been a $995 resource, we're offering for $695. Now, I know that's $695, okay? So I had a guy buy it one time for $6.95, and then we billed him for $695, and he had to return it, so I want to be really clear that he got home and his treasurer was like, what have you done? You know? And I'm like, well, look, you know, we tried to give you a good deal, but $695, it's $695. Now, I know you're thinking, well, that's a lot of money, and it's not for everybody. It's only for those of you who think they have a capital campaign. But whether you use Steve as a capital campaign consultant or not, which I recommend Steve because he's a pastor who's actually leading capital campaigns, and he can help you lead a capital campaign, better than, I think, these big organizations, which I won't name, but you know who they are, these big organizations who do this. But even if you're using a big organization, what if you could get Steve's brain, you know, and for less than 1% of what you're going to pay these other big companies, you know what's going on. So if you're trying to raise $20 million, I mean, $695 is nothing. I mean, even if you're trying to raise $3 million, mm-hmm. you know, $695 is nothing. And what you get is you get his 30 years of experience in doing capital campaigns. And so that's not for everybody, I know, but I've watched these DVDs, and I'm not even in a capital campaign, and I learned how to better do a Christmas offering, how to better talk to big donors. I mean, I learned a lot of tips just with that. But if you're interested in that, we have four of these. Is there anything you want to add to that?
Yeah, the only thing I would say is if you get the DVD and the notebook and you go through the whole thing and you say, you know what, I've learned a whole lot, but I still feel a little uncomfortable trying to raise $1 million, $2 or $3 million, I will credit hire me to come do your capital campaign, I'll credit you for the DVD. I'll give that money back to you to do the DVD. And I also say this, is that my fees for capital campaigns are about somewhere around about 50% of what you would pay those other capital campaigns. And the reason is I don't have to run a website, I don't have to write all the four color brochures, and I don't have to pay office overhead and that type of thing. And I only do about three or four a year, but it will be cheaper and you will get as good or better of a product. And when you hire some of those companies to do that, they're going to send somebody out there they trained to do it who's not pastoring a church and who haven't ever raised one in their church. So you're going to get a better quality campaign for half of the price. But I'd start here. Look at it. Look at the material. And if it works for you, then just do it yourself. If it doesn't work for you with all the letters and everything else, and you want somebody actually, not everybody can run their own capital campaign. You have to be wired to do that or have somebody on your staff who's wired to do that, but you might be able to. If so, do that. If not, I'll refund you the price of this off of the fee that I would charge you. So those are a couple of options.
Yeah, and one thing, I saw an ad yesterday in a magazine I write for, one of these, you know, big magazines like Rev Outreach, Christianity Today type deals, and one of the capital campaign companies out there, they're charging you $3,000 to come to an event to learn how to lead your own capital campaign. And if you've ever been to one of those, you know you go to those events and you walk away and you don't get the forms, you don't get the resources, you don't even get a copy of the training. Actually, I think what they try to do is they try to confuse you at the $3,000 event, so then you'll pay the $500,000 or whatever it takes to do the event. But with this one, as you can see with Steve, I mean, this is Steve at the whiteboard, Steve with his notes, and Steve telling you anything. So everything that he knows about that. So anyway, you can take a look at that. It's not for everybody, but it's back there. So all that's back at the resource table. It's just on the honor system. You pick it up. Christina has order forms. You can pay by credit card. Our banks won't let us take checks, I believe, so we can do credit card or if you need to get us a check, you can send us a check and we'll send you the resources later. But anyway, that's just kind of how it is. So it's been a good morning. It's 10:45 right now. Let's start back in 10 minutes. And the first person to go to the restroom, prop the door open for everybody else, okay? And there's some food back here in case you came in late and you didn't get it. Some food, some coffee. Grab all of that.
Let's be back at 5 to 11 because we got lots of material to cover.